Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that would have no objections at all to being appointed Queen of the Universe. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Natty Longshoe's comical electrolytic spa and sauna for this one.
Well, everyone loved the Doctor's wife, of course, and so Neil Gaiman is back to try his hand at a script which recreates all of his most resonant childhood fears and which demands the credible realization of about 3 million Cybermen. What could possibly go wrong as Angie and Artie confront a nightmare in silver? So am I right? Everyone hates this episode. No. There were people clambering over each other to get on this episode of FTE and get a good solid rant on. Is that right?
I thought people were clambering over each other to get off this episode of FTE.
Most episodes.
I mean, I have some sympathy with the people who hate it. I don't hate it myself because it just doesn't rouse that much in me.
Right.
Yes. I think this is a very successful episode of the Sarah Jane Adventures.
You know, I think that there is something about childhood fear, which is a thing that Gaiman is very definitely into. And so we have these kids who have kind of inveigled their way onto the TARDIS at the end of last episode, and we're kind of telling it from their point of view, but then they're kind of suddenly sidelined and stuff, and so it ends up not being about what it probably ought to be about.
This is the W.C. Fields, and he was actually, you know, when he famously said, don't work with animals or children. But what he was actually saying in the, you know, in the 30s films that he did, and some of them did have both of these avenues of thespian intent, is that they require so much absolute genius directing and then editing and very cautious, very, even with a brilliant child. And I did like the little girl Angie's sparks and her anger. And I did like that they are actually both mirror selves of Clara's personality.
I like posh little Artie. You know, he's got this terrible posh voice and he's a member of the chess club because, of course, he is.
But then there's the cantankerous son of a Angie, who is just, you know, the thing we all love to hate. But no, I just honestly think this could have been it's almost there. Maybe if it had Disney's production crew behind it and their editing suites and their directors. What? Okay, I will say up front, I just think it comes down to time and directing. I think everyone does their absolute best. Matt doesn't look like he's being directed.
No.
So he's just doing it as Matt would feel he's doing it. It feels like a very competent rehearsal shoot.
Yeah. I think that that's actually the problem. So the director of this episode has never directed another Doctor Who episode.
Astonish me.
Yeah, his name is Stephen Wolfenden and he doesn't come back. And I think, I'm going to say it, I think he's bad. I think this is a badly directed episode, and nearly everything that goes wrong with it comes down to that.
This episode feels to me like a difficult second album in the writing.
Yeah.
So it's The Doctor's Wife was a pretty tight marriage between Neil Gaiman's brand and Doctor Who. This feels like Neil Gaiman without much to say. So it's pretty scattershot. He's got some ideas there, but there's nothing really driving it. And so it's tricked out with all kinds of diversions, like bizarrely whimsical characters who don't really fit the narrative or drive it forward. And I think that extends to the production. It feels like there wasn't really a tone meeting. So nothing's really on the same page.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what we're seeing on screen, really. It's bizarrely unfocused.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is I think that Gaiman gets such an incredible director in Richard Clarke in his last episode. He is relying on having a director that good. And, like, you know, there's a scene kind of early on where the Doctor puts Angie and Artie to bed and says, you know, don't wander off, otherwise we might have to go rescuing and or someone might have to go and rescue you or something. And one of the kids says, you know, rescue what from? You know, like there's clearly some sort of danger and the Doctor refuses to say anything and he just leaves. And then you get Angie leaves and you've got Artie by himself in this room full of waxworks, and it's meant to be terrifying. It's meant to be about childhood terror, and that's why you have sort of incompetent adults and people not telling you the truth and stuff like that. You know, if this had been more like Night Terrors, if this had been more about, like, nightmare is in the name. If this had been more directly about the fears of childhood, and if it had had a consistent aesthetic, it might have worked.
Well, it suffers from the Doctor's daughter, itis, in that I think, you know, we've seen many times in Doctor Who, in episodes like The Leisure Hive and The Girl Who Waited, that a fairly unremarkable script can be totally brought home by the design.
Yeah.
And what this needed was a consistent design ethos, something that made you believe in the fairly whimsical and bizarre world that it's producing. But actually, it's the Doctor's daughter. It ends up being shot in a castle with kind of gels on the lights.
It actually uses this, one of the same locations. The barracks is the same location as the
theater.
The human's base, the theater.
Do you know, I actually thought that when I was watching, I looked and I thought, this doesn't really suit what it's going for. It's just like the Doctor's daughter. And isn't that funny? It's actually the Doctor's daughter.
Yeah.
I actually think the settings and all the rest of it are very Gaiman, but it comes down to, like, you know, there are at least 20 I can think of Hammer Horrors, one of which stars Adrian Corey and Lala Ward.
Ooh,
I'm trying to remember what that one's called. It's about 97.
The Leisure Hive?
Is it something about vampires?
It's usually about vampires. But there's a Zombieland came out a couple of years before with Woody Harrelson, which is almost the same plot. Again, set in a fun fair. It's a grand tradition of similar, going all the way back to Robert Wiener's Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which we might have mentioned. I mean, it's really sound notions of how to set up a thing like this and get the drama happening and get the audience involved. And I sort of think it just, maybe it's just down to rushing. I don't even know that the shots of the directors are actually all that bad. I think the Cybermen are shot very nicely. There's camera angles that, you know, with the number of crew that you've got, the movement is gorgeous. He's got the speed working. A little child would be, you know, this is the thing with Gaiman that I'm trying to say. He writes so beautifully of children for children as readers. And I'm thinking Graveyard Book, which is actually one of my favorite children's books
terrific.
Of all time.
Yeah.
And the subtleties and the nuances that he expects from his characters and therefore from his actors, is, I just feel, beyond the actual structure of Doctor Who in the time they have. If he'd been writing for adult characters, I think we'd have a different, we just don't get genuineness from this. And that's what Peter was saying before.
I mean, if you look at the two children in The Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe, where you've got Lily and Cyril, who are well-defined characters, and it is an older sister and a younger brother, and I think that they're better defined. Angie and Artie, I think the idea is that they're kind of naturalistic and they're, you know, Angie in particular is a sort of bolshy, annoying teenager who's not impressed by anything. And, like, that's kind of okay, but they're just not characterized clearly enough, I think, is the problem. And, I mean, as for the setting, like, the crumbling funfair is a great classic setting. We're looking back on childhood, on our own childhood and the fears that inhabited our childhood. So the crumbling funfair is perfect, but it's one shot. You know, it's one effects shot. It doesn't feel like it's set in a crumbling funfair at all.
No, it's that modern Doctor Who cliche of basically looking out a door at a digital effects shot.
Yeah.
And it just brings home how cruelly that opening scene, which is meant to be a moonscape, is actually just a corner of the studio with a bit of green screen. screen behind it.
Do you think that's a moon base reference?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought they were going to do a Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick riff, and I was getting a bit excited about that. But the Hammer horror films that he's referencing, Vampire Circus is the Lala Ward.
Here we go.
David Pruce is in it as well. And the other one I'm thinking of is Waxwork with David Warner and Patrick McNee from the late 80s, which is hilarious and looks... Yeah, this has got really strong legs. They just, they've just got crumbly knees.
It's what you were saying earlier, Richard. It's so hard to bring in successfully something which is meant to be about kids and scary for kids. So for every Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, you've just got a miss like this where you think these moments which should work don't.
Well, I mean, look at what Richard Clarke manages to do with Night Terrors, which is not a good script, I don't think, but it has a real proper look to it.
It's so beautifully shot. It's shot like a Cronenberg. It's definitely looking at David Cronenberg's early stuff. And I'm actually thinking of the harsh overlighting and the saturation of The Fly, which was actually a Mel Brooks film. Did you know that? Anyway, yeah. But no, it was. Mel Brooks created a lot of those great schlocky horror things in the 80s and 90s. But yeah, the lighting, directing, I honestly think it just comes down to if you're working with children, you need a lot more time and some very judicial cuts.
Yeah.
And it's the perils of bringing YA fiction to the screen. I was talking to a friend of the podcast about this episode last night, and he said it feels like a live-action cartoon. And I'd agree with that. It's got a very Scooby-Doo feel to it, and I'm not sure that that's what Gaiman was going for.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. No, the sort of crumbling past its time, you know, dark, you know, a childhood that's sort of haunted by strange fears. It's all just too kind of slapdash, I think, in just the visual look of it.
And far too grand a scale for what they can achieve in the time.
Yeah, but I mean, if they'd given us that effect shot of the crumbling funfair, and then we had seen them in there, do you know what I mean? Tighter shots with actual sort of practical set elements that...
Which placed them in, in that glass painting.
Yeah, basically. Rather than just looking out at the glass painting. I think it's a problem.
It's the kind of story I think that they might have actually done better back in the 1980s in a Sylvester McCoy three-parter, because they would, like the Happiness Patrol, they would have gamely approached making this funfair in the studio. Yeah. And it probably would have worked in that kind of that way that the Happiness Patrol does.
And with the sort of the falseness, the facade of a funfair would work really well.
That's a good point, actually.
With cheap sets instead of locations.
Well, I mean, if you think about what happened in The Doctor's Wife, where you've got that crashed spaceship that is an effect shot, but that the characters are interacting underneath it. They're integrated into that shot. There's a real proper sense of place, and it's the sort of place that this needed to have, I think.
It needs to feel more like theatre.
Yeah.
In the way that the early German filmmakers, Nosferatu is 100 years old this year. I thought we were looking quite good. is that you're working, as you were both saying, Peter and James, you're working with flats, so angle them, play with them and harshly light them and make them surreal, make them hyper-real. Actually, I think it's a question of timing and, more time with the actors. Actually, the biggest letdown for me isn't the children. It's Matt being given a lot of exposition time, and there's not a lot of pitch and yaw in what he's doing.
No. I think the script needs the Doctor and Mr. Clever to be indistinguishable from one another from the outside, you know, so Clara has to guess which person she's interacting with. But I think it's just a lot of effort to put Matt through. And I think he tries to make it watchable, but I don't think he's being given any direction, as you said before.
He's the over-eager substitute teacher for this episode, trying to win us all over. And you're just trying, you just haven't got the tone right.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that before, that multiple personality disorder effect where one person snaps between things. And I think Matt puts in a game effort to pull it off, but I'm just not sure. I think it's a tall order.
There's so no one much really of could. It.
Was this shot in a hurry, this one? Do we know the history?
I think it just looks like it was shot in a hurry.
Because it is a 50th anniversary Cyberman story. That's a very special thing.
I know, Cyberman anniversary stories are always so good.
Thank you, Silver Nemesis. We still love you, don't we?
Well, it's even got gold in it.
Yeah, yeah. Gold's back. Cleaning fluid.
Oh, yes. Lots of lovely nods.
Of course, Neil Gaiman watched The Moonbase before this.
Oh, yeah. And he probably watched it as a child. He's the age to have watched it as a child.
He is a Doctor Who fan.
Yeah, he said the Cybermen were the most terrifying.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people say this, but when has that been proven?
When you're five.
I think this is, someone pointed out, the second time this half of the season has gone back to season five. You know, we've got Cold War doing a base under siege, and now we've got this doing the Cybermen attacking a base.
You're right.
We've got the Sea Week next week.
And we know that Matt loved Pat Troughton's work, so, yeah.
I think that Cold War is boring is the problem. It's an unambitious script.
I thoroughly enjoyed it because of that. I just liked that it was an episode of The Champions that just happened to be in Doctor Who.
That's fair enough. I think this is more interesting than that, but it just works less well because it's something the show doesn't seem to be able to pull off.
I think the thing that fails for me about this episode is that the Doctor's Wife is the Doctor Who story that Gaiman has wanted to write his entire life.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. It's an amazing concept. This is Neil Gaiman as a Doctor Who fan going, how do I write a Doctor Who story?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll just chuck all of the sort of things that scared me about the Cybermen as a child into a melting pot. And it's just, it's a mess. It's a bit of a nothing burger of a story.
That's what I said at the start. The Doctor's Wife was a tight marriage between Neil Gaiman's brand and Doctor Who, whereas this is an open marriage. This is very loose.
There's a version of this story that nearly works, though. If this is a story about Gaiman's own childhood fears watching Doctor Who with the Cybermen in it, and because he does childhood fears, you know, that's part of his sort of brand, it's not hard to imagine a version of this that's well directed and that coheres around that idea. And I just think the problem is that it's so flat and unambitiously directed.
It's like those Doctor versus Doctor scenes. I see where that's coming from, and I see how you might think we can rely on Matt to make this work. But the way that it's presented is a fantasy writer's idea of a sci-fi concept. And so when we go into Matt's brain and you've got the Doctor and Mr. Clever talking to each other, the way that it's mounted is not that different from the Matrix in the Arc of Infinity.
Yeah.
You know, things haven't moved on. There's no more visual impact to those scenes than there were in Arc of Infinity.
Wait till next week. How do we feel about the redesign of the Cybermen? Because I am going to, again, put my cards on the table and say I really hate it.
Brendan pointed out to me the other day that this Cyberman redesign is basically the MCU's Iron Man.
Yeah.
And he's right.
It really is.
It just needs a nice paint job.
I think the problem is that it's so clearly plastic or whatever. I mean, the previous costumes are made out of fiberglass, are they? And they're painted with metallic paint because it was important for Russell that they should be made of steel, that they were people in steel armor and they were wearing the steel armor to protect them against their inherent vulnerability. And, you know, it's the emotional vulnerability that destroys them at the end of The Age of Steel. But they needed to look like steel. These ones look like plastic, I think.
There's something that could work about them. The idea that they're segmented.
Yeah.
In the same way that a Cybermat is.
And that they could change form. I wanted to see them do Phantom Agents things and turn into bowling balls. That's a reference for the older listeners.
There's just not there's something that doesn't quite work about them.
No.
I think they're too slick and well-designed. And as you say, they do look like an ersatz made in Hong Kong iron person toy that you'd see at the Easter show.
Yeah, yeah. That's right, a knockoff one.
So for the body horror that Neil Gaiman is going for, which again is an uncomfortable marriage with what we actually get on screen, the design doesn't really work for it. The faces don't look very skull-like. They look kind of like smooth and, as you said, Nathan, plasticky and not very frightening, actually.
It's a bit of a nod to Metropolis. It's a bit of a nod to Fritz Lang. They have definitely a deco inspiration there. But they're also a 1930s car hood ornament.
Yeah. <They're so> I think the featurelessness of the face is probably trying to hark back to the original look. Yeah. And that's kind of fair enough, I guess. I just don't think it works.
They don't. Well, there's a reason we don't see them much more, isn't there?
Well, except that they're going to be in the finale next year, aren't they? And they are those Cybermen. And then we'll see.
So we've made them all.
That's right. And then we'll see all of the different costumes hauled out for the end of Series 10.
The Cybermen only get scary again when you bring back Sandra's latex body stockings.
Yes, I think so.
And gimp mask.
They are really terrifying.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something about those 1960 Cybermen where they're scary, where they're up close to you. Yes. So if Cybermen in the 60s get up close to you, they chop you or they grab you and they're big and they're overbearing and they're visceral. These don't look like any of those things. It doesn't look scary if it gets within 2 feet of you. In fact, when one does get within 2 feet of Clara and she swings that thing at her, it's pretty lame.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's that weird effect shot of just like thousands and thousands of them marching in. And I don't know how they manage to make that boring, but they really do. It's so lifeless.
It's not much of a climax, is it?
No.
Also, plot question, and I've watched it twice now to try and work out how. So we're all in direapparel.com and Matt's covered in gorgeous 7 of 9 facial jewelry effect thing, like he's going to the worst pride festival time and because it's going to get hot if you're wearing that all day. And then they're back on the set of The End of the World and everything's fabulous. And we've got Willow, one of Willow's mates. We've got the lovely Warwick Davies, who just makes everything warm and wonderful and really carries a scene just by being in the scene. Yeah. I think, I don't believe any of this. Oh, but then there's Warwick Davies, and actually I don't know how he does it. He grounds things, probably not just by looking at everyone in the room saying, I'm not buying your shtick.
I think he is magnificent. I think he is really good and maybe the best thing about it.
Yeah, he is.
And I can't decide whether going back to the Temple of Peace and putting a view screen in is a horrifically bad misstep or a sort of delightful ignorance of how spaceships normally get realized in Doctor Who. And I might land with the second one. It is kind of fun. And there is that effect shot as the spaceship flies off where we're looking into the room in the Temple of Peace through the...
With him sitting on the little throne.
Yeah, you know, like I think that's kind of okay. He is really good. And so it's that thing where he blows up the planet with the Cybermen on it by using his...
A ghetto blaster.
Yes, using the ghetto blaster.
Oh, it is a ghetto blaster.
Yeah, it takes this ghetto blaster. Yeah.
That effect is the most explosive implosion I've ever seen.
It's more of an unexplosion. I like how Angie is the one who works out that he's the emperor. That's pretty good. That scene at the end, I don't know. I think it is strange, but I think it's going for strange.
It is. Warwick Davis is charming in the role. Yeah. But the character, again, even in the constraints of this bizarre world that we created, this universe, doesn't work. So he's the emperor and he's sick of ruling the empire. But does that mean that he wants to spend his days manipulating an empty Cyberman?
Sitting in a box playing chess.
In a mechanical Turk, discarded funfair. How the frickin' long has he been sitting in that commode? In the working bit of the commode.
Had a commode.
It's not commodious at all. It doesn't really work, does it?
But the world that this episode creates is one that I'm kind of weirdly interested in because It's a future. We don't know when it is or anything about it. We don't know where it's set. It's one of those empires that has a bunch of galaxies, you know, in it. So it could kind of be anywhere. You look up at the night sky and there's a massive hole in the night sky where they've detonated an entire galaxy and killed trillions upon trillions of people. And there's a thing called the Siberiad, and we don't know what it is, but it's like their version of the internet or Wikipedia or something.
Or the Borg hive mind.
Yeah, yeah. And we've got cyber mites, which I think that's
love
quite good.
Great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I would have liked more of the shot of them being tossed onto Matt, so to speak, because that is quite disturbing.
It is, and that shot is just thrown away. Yeah. It's like Captain Blonde Hair Lipstick's death, just thrown away in the
Did you want to speak to that, Peter?
Not really.
I wasn't even sure she was dead. Like, I thought they were so poorly done.
Yeah. Is this a performance dead? Note?
Yeah. No, Tamsin Halthwaite was just sleepwalking.
So she's a big name. She's EastEnders.
Yeah, she was Mel Owen in EastEnders, and it's that sliding scale of soap stars in Doctor Who where you're at the very top with Tracy Ann, Cyberman.
And Louise Jameson.
Well, absolutely, although that's the wrong way around. And then you sort of scrape the bottom of the barrel with Captain Nemo 42. Yeah. Yeah, that's her. And I don't think that Tamsin Halthwaite does very well.
She's not quite at the bottom of the barrel, but she is looking at it.
Exactly. But that's where all the delicious fruity lees are.
And in fact, I have a problem with that string of characters that make up the Punishment Platoon. I think it feels like a tacked on effort to give these characters something to hang on, because they don't really fulfill a function in the plot. They're not driving forward any of the ideas.
I was waiting for Georgia Moffat MacDonald to swoop back in and rescue us all, only to be cruelly disapparated at some point or another. It did feel a bit Jenny.
Yeah. So they don't even have names. Like, one's called Beauty, one's called Brains, and the fat guy is called Ha Ha.
I just call him the James Corden one.
Yeah, the James Corden one.
Ouch.
What is that? I mean, he does that, doesn't he? He does it in The Doctor's Wife. The characters are called Idris, Uncle, Auntie, House.
And all of that is integral to the story in The Doctor's Wife.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's stuff that's left out of this. Maybe it was meant to be a two-parter. Maybe it was written as a longer.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of stuff to get through in 45 minutes.
But the thing is, those are character names in The Doctor's Wife. These are just descriptions
They are.
Of what their plot
function is. Because they don't get names in dialogue, so he just calls them anything.
Yeah, like boy matter. One, boy two.
Yeah, fair enough.
Angie, Artie.
It does feel a bit Eurovision, doesn't it? So what's your band called?
It does. I didn't think that gingerhead guy could act in Skins, and he can't act here either.
And I didn't recognize any of them. I also still don't understand why it's a punishment force. I don't know why they're at a circus.
Yeah. Thing. So they were put there. So they had been in the army, is that the understanding? And they had refused to obey orders. So the captain says that she had been given the order to explode a planet and she didn't do it before. And so there's meant to be a tension between Clara and her, because Clara has been told not to let her blow up the planet, and she's already suffering in this punishment thing, and that they're stuck here because it's the middle of nowhere and they can't.
It's meant
do
to be the
damage.
Army's Zed platoon.
Yeah. What do we think about Clara in this episode?
Treading water very quickly.
I do love how she's doing Sarah Jane Smith's season 11 accent for the episode.
It does rock up the amphorabic, doesn't it? Isn't that Jenna's own?
Yeah, I think so.
Leaking through.
I think like she hadn't settled on it properly by this point where she was pitching the character.
And yet Dodo got so much flack.
And that was all from me.
I think it's a little bit of a step down. And is it because last week's episode was recorded after this?
I just don't think she's very well catered for.
I think she's very good in last week's episode.
I think she's very good in this too. Again, it's what am I supposed to do with this scene? Look feisty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And resolute and yet sort of vulnerable and is my, you know, and lip glossy. And again, it all gets very French and Saunders very quickly, doesn't it? You could really say she's the one with the penknife in this episode. I actually would have liked it if it had. I need more comedy in this.
Yeah.
It needs something to rescue it. What did Graham Williams' era, which everyone looked, you know, there was all those years later of saying, oh, it was terrible, it was terrible. I can tell you at 12 years of age, it was fantastic. And the asides and the buffoonery and Tom saying, well, this is a bit piss, isn't it, Lala? You know, pretty much to camera.
Yeah.
Or, you know, actually, he was doing that more with Mary. There was a whole lot of, we know this is, and it just worked. You get a bit meta and have some fun with it.
It's because of that interplay between the comedy and the horror. There's a lightness there, even if it's not deliberate, even if it's Tom hamming it up. The comedy, yeah. The comedy often actually works with, like, with the horror.
It just, maybe this is just all rushed. Do we know if Matt and Jenna Louise were getting on really well?
I think
well
they got on
this?
Fine. I mean, I don't think it was Matt and Karen, but then nothing was. And actually, when I was watching it, I kept thinking that Amy would be a better fit for the Clara role in this because she would have played that kind of fish out of water, thrust into an authority role, but not quite able to pull it off in a more human way. I don't believe in Clara as a real person in this episode.
Again, we're umbrellaed never to believe. And we keep being reminded she's impossible.
Yeah.
She's not really a person.
It is a problem, I think, because the... Well, because the mystery, and we've said this before this year, the mystery is that, in fact, there is no mystery. She's just an ordinary person. And we find that out for sure next week.
Yeah.
I think, you know, because she's an ordinary person, that kind of limits how she can play it. She's a mystery but an ordinary person, and there's something hanging over the characterization combined with the fact that it's all being shot out of order, which just means that it never properly lands, I think. And so I think she's fairly appealing, but there's nothing to the character at the moment.
Because the character is the arc of the season, there can be no development for her over the course of that arc because it's all discovering the mystery of what she was in the beginning.
Yeah, and we still get that here. I mean, we have the Mr. Clever discovering the impossible girl and telling Clara that the impossible girl is her and something that the doctor's obsessing about. And the doctor kind of tries to talk his way out of it, I think, later. But it does come up again, and that's got to not be Gaiman, does it? That has to be Moffat doing that. Anyway, it just doesn't end up being very good, and I don't think she's got this role, which is potentially interesting, but nothing really comes of it.
Yeah, and I think that the episodes that are shot later obviously were scripted later, and Moffat has a better handle on what he wants to do with the character.
Yeah.
So we're a bit all over the place. It's season 19, Tegan.
Yeah. You know,
changing from story to story.
So much so. So which was this in shooting order?
I'm not precisely sure, but I know that the Snowmen, Crimson Horror, and the Name of the Doctor, so anything which had to do with Vastra and her group were all shot towards the end.
Yeah, so that you can have
a lot.
So you can have those characters and lovely Richard E. Grant phoning it in as well. So they all had to be shot when everyone's available at the same time in a block.
Now that's interesting because yes, there is a very different characterization from the act from Jim.
And there's a consistency in the characterization and the tone of all of those episodes as well between each other.
And Jenna is very assured playing the Snowmen version. So she's obviously hit on what to do with the character and how to present it.
Actually, that's my favorite of her performances. And maybe in Deep Breath as well. She has moments when she's asked to just react. I can see why she was cast. She's really brilliant in reactive shots. Not everyone can do that.
There is a bit of an obsession with Cybermen stories flashing up shot, like publicity shots from earlier Doctor Who.
I really loved that. No, not the mind probe. Yeah, it was nice. I could see Pertwee with one knee up strapped to the table again. All of that's Day of the Daleks. And they're gorgeous shots. And then they culminate with Matt Smith doing his terrific Duke of Edinburgh Award grin into the camera.
Like, think about the way that it just rips off the design of Tomb of the Cybermen in a way that kind of excited me.
It was so exciting. We've got little half roundels you can climb up again.
Yeah, like, it's odd that that never sort of turns up, and it maybe that's a Moffat thing. Like, in a year's time or so, we'll have a Dalek city that has the doorways from the Daleks.
I can't wait to talk about how the external design is lifted from the TV21 comics that James and I are a bit pash about. So there'll be more yarveling to come.
But the, you know, that scene where the Cybermen, you know, all 3 million Cybermen are coming out of the thing is just that.
Is it 3 million, James? How many was it?
It was a very big number.
It was, wasn't it?
Like, I think that is kind of cool, and that's the sort of thing that we're going to see before. And so it is, I think, Gaiman having childhood memories of watching the moon base, which is why we get the spacey zoomer scene with everyone jumping up and down in an unconvincing moon surface set. And then we get the Cybermen coming out of the thing as what is supposed to be the high point, but again is sort of weirdly thrown away. It could have been really thrilling. It could have been like the fantastic march on the like on the bridge of whatever that spaceship is, Beryl Reed's spaceship at the end of Earthshock episode 3. But somehow it doesn't have – it's not that exciting.
It's kind of missing one of those long zoom ins on Peter Davison's face.
As he screams, no!
Cyberman! Not my feelings. Don't get them in the shot.
It's almost like the episode pulls its punches a little bit, because if that's what Neil Gaiman is going for – the Cybermites should be the scariest thing ever.
Yeah.
They should be like the Cybermats in Tomb of the Cybermen, which sort of leap onto you and they look like some kind of leech was attached to you. Yep. Whereas what happens here when we mentioned that scene earlier where the Doctor gets a handful of Cybermites thrown at him and we pull away into long shot.
Yeah.
He turns and then he has prosthetic on. Like, I would have liked to see them, and you're not going to do this in Doctor Who, but burrow into his skin.
They could have done that in Doctor Who.
Yeah,
of course they could. Yeah, it is pulling its punches. It's just, I don't know. It's a bit depressing, but I just think it's kind of terribly lackluster.
The whole thing is kind of a bit meh.
Yeah.
And it really shouldn't have been. Like, there, you're right. There are ideas working here.
Night. Meh.
No.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself.
I don't think it deserves the sort of hatred that it gets. I mean, Todd and friend of the podcast, Joe Ford, and a number of other people.
All your other husbands.
Yeah, yes. They were all desperate to be on this episode.
The husbands of Nathan Bottom.
to rip it to pieces.
Yeah, but... Oh, no, that is fun, isn't it?
I don't know how you could get that worked up over this episode.
Well, it is a bit like that all the way through 7B, in a way. There are episodes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We've got a new title sequence.
It's
new,
a series of episodes that just don't quite deliver on their promise.
No.
So,
it feels like
Hyde, Cold War, this.
Yes. This season, which is what – thank you. That's what I wanted to say before. It feels like a series of comic novel adaptions, as we now call them, or actually just comics, as we used to say. Yeah. So there were some really good ones coming out at the time that I think Titan were doing, and James and I think have copies of them. They're hardbound. I can't remember the names of them anyway, but who cares? But there's, you know, and because there's more in them and the graphics of it all, yeah, these feel like comic strips for TV, which can be a very fractious, thin line to draw upon, because you still require – Jenna does it very well. Matt does it very well. Karen did it sublimely. If you're going to shoot like that and you're going to write like that, you've got to have the reactive shots. Perfect. Yeah.
You know what it is for me? It's season 20.
Ouch, that's so mean.
We're back at the Arc of Infinity.
Well, especially with the, you know, the shots with the two doctors in the sort of void space. That's very Arc of Infinity.
Mm-hmm. It is.
With better graphics.
Oh, that's a horrible thing to say. The Hadron Collider thing.
That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week to try and wrap up all of this nonsense in the name of the Doctor. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger, Jodie Into Terror, Maximum Power, and Untitled Star Trek Project. Until next time, remember that the future is stupid despite the abundance of phone service. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good thening.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths, James Selwood and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, shot in a hurry, was recorded on the 26th of June 2022 and released on the 16th of October. To apologise to those of you who tuned in expecting us to get our rant on this week. Be assured that we will all be well fed and well rested just in time for our episode on The Caretaker, which will probably be released about May 2023.
Sorry, what was the other thing? We were just
Jason Watkins.
The little guy playing the usual Neil Gaiman thing of, and it's very Dickensian, and it's also very early horror of the little cute guy with the top hat.
And
he turns out, and then he's got all the face flash on.
Yeah.
Who was that?
So that's actor? Jason Watkins, who I think is an extremely good actor.
He's great in everything else.
So I am the only person, James and I are the only two people ever to watch the English Being Human all the way through to the end.
Yes.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, which is Toby Whithouse. That's
lovely
his Toby
show. He plays like a head vampire.
In it. And
he's amazing. I think I want to go and watch that.
He's fantastic in comedy.
He is absolutely terrifying. I've never seen anything like it because he's kind of like a doughy middle-aged man.
I'm right here.
We all are. He's not physically imposing in any way.
That's right, yeah.
But he is absolutely terrifying as Herrick in Being Human. And so I was super excited to see him the first time I saw this, but it doesn't go anywhere.
No.
And I think he plays the kind of Borgified version of himself quite well. You know, it's
not much to do, is there?
No, but it's not, you know, he's not playing it as a robot or anything. He's still playing it as a sort of version of himself. But again, it all just seems to be it all just seems to not add up to anything very much.
Yeah. So what was he in that I remember him from?
He's in Psychoville series 2. He collects Nazi memorabilia in a toy
shop. Not in Victoria.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's where I'm thinking of him from.
He's very gay in that. Yeah. Let's try and get it out happening because we're 51
done now, aren't we?
I think we're done.
Peter?
A hard episode to talk about.
Yeah, it really is. There's nothing very much here. Just wait till you hear next week's episode.
Did we talk enough about Angie and Artie?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're all right. Mm. All right, what do you reckon? I think there's something. I'll find something. I mean, I think next week is the same problem. It is.
What's next week?
Next week is The Name of the Doctor, which is just...
Oh, you're recording that next week?
We're recording it now.
Okay.
It's just Moffat vamping. Like, it's all of Moffat's things. He's just vamping for 45 minutes. And because he's a good writer and he's got, you know, a great semi-regular cast happening, it's watchable, but it doesn't really amount to anything. And, like, when you compare it to the previous weird single episode season finale, which was also him sort of vamping in a way and relying on that regular cast, it's much better. It's much more interesting and colourful and stuff than Name of the Doctor.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, the thing I enjoyed most about this episode was that Angie and Artie were so middle class.
Even
after everything that they've been through, Artie's there at the end saying, "This is the most fun I've had in my whole life," to the Doctor. I wish I could sympathize, Artie.
That's our out.
That's very grim.
There is that thing where the kids are sort of obnoxious, you know, like they get their way onto the TARDIS and she's all, "Oh, the future is so boring and this is all so crap.
Put me down, I hate you."
Yeah, but then they're into it. Like there's supposed to be an arc where they discover that actually they've had fun and it's all been great and they're kind of
implanted.
Kids.
Yeah, but their neocortex has been stabbed and burned with hot wires.
Yeah, and I love the fact that she has a space phone. It doesn't just say there's no connection. It has to flash up in big hitchhiker's letters, "No service."
All right, I'm going to press stop.